nice little section that we're reading now from 61 to 64 is so unique because they're all have to do with Krishna's family. They're like all his family business. There's more on his family, but he's on one level they sound so ordinary. Of course, even when Krishna does ordinary things, he does them in an extraordinary way. But they have each of the 61 to 64 have their very significant, sometimes subtle, but very significant points that are important for us to understand about Krishna, and important for us to understand about the process of advancing Krishna consciousness. So in this one, what do you remember from yesterday?
I can't see the list of the wives and their sons.
Yeah, because look at it from a mundane point of view. If Krishna was a mundane person, he's just talking about his family. Gramyakata, Sunive, just my wife's this and his wife's this, and we had 10 children. And but of course, when Krishna does something, he does it in such an exceptional way that he has 10 children from each of the wives, and he's got 16,000 wives. So for something superficially ordinary is certainly extraordinary. So we're just up to the point where Krishna's son, his first son named Pradyumna, married Rukmavati, who was Rukmi's son, daughter. And it's quite interesting the way it's described that Rukmi naturally didn't want to give his daughter to his enemy's child. So it describes that he considered it, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur said that he considered it irreligious to do so. So from the point of view of Rukmini's brother, so that what's the relationship there then between Rukmini's son and his daughter, their cousins, right? So it says specifically that he didn't think it was irreligious. He didn't think it was an irreligious act, and he didn't want to. He didn't really sanction it, but to please Rukmini, he did sanction it. But the reason why it was irreligious, he thought it was irreligious, wasn't from that point of view, but he thought it was irreligious because giving your daughter to your enemy to marry. And then Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur quotes some shastra, of several different shastric references to show that you shouldn't accept food from an enemy, you shouldn't interact with an enemy in an intimate way. These are just dharma shastra type of things. And even if something is a religious performance, if it's going to be harmful for you, one shouldn't engage in it. So from that type of a religious point of view, on the level of Dharma Shastra, Rukmi didn't want to give his daughter to the son of Krishna, because Krishna was his enemy. And then, but he did it anyway to please Rukmini. So not only did that happen, but also the son of Pradyumna was Aniruddha, and actually Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur describes that as it says that she accepted him in a in a Swayamvara ceremony. So Rukmi didn't want to give, to be known as giving something to Krishna, giving his daughter in Krishna in charity. So he arranged it. He knew that she wanted to marry Alikisa. He knew that she wanted to marry Pradyumna. And he knew that Rukmini wanted her to marry Pradyumna. So what he did to save his false ego, his false prestige, he arranged that she have a Swayamvara ceremony so she could pick her own husband, so he wouldn't be the one who was choosing his enemy's son for his daughter, his own dear beloved daughter. Anyway, this is the way of diplomacy. So not only was it so peculiar in one sense that Pradyumna married Rukmavati, but also Pradyumna's son Aniruddha, also to please Rukmini Devi. His granddaughter, whose name I think was Rotsana, it was arranged that she marry Aniruddha. So this chapter and the next chapter and the following chapter are really about Aniruddha, who's such a great and powerful hero, and his different exploits in regard to marriage. So Aniruddha, there's going to be a great marriage ceremony between Rukmi's granddaughter Rotsana and Krishna's grandson Aniruddha, and the ceremony wasn't going to be held in Dwarka, but it was going to be held in, I think the name was Bodhaka or something like that, the place of Rukmi, because Rukmi, after he was defeated by Krishna, and then he vowed not to go home to his capital city of Kundina again, so he set up another city in this Bodhaka. So the ceremony was going to be held there, and Rukmini came, and Krishna came, and Balaram came, and Aniruddha came, and some of the other relatives all came there. It was a joyous ceremony. So that's what's being described here. So King Prickett said, how could Rukmi give his daughter to his enemy's son? After all, Rukmi had been defeated by Lord Krishna in battle, and this was waiting for an opportunity to kill him. So that's how strong the enmity was. He was just looking for an opportunity to kill him. Please explain this to me, O learned one, how these two inimical parties became united through marriage. Mystic yogis can perfectly see. So Maharaj Prickett is subtly telling him, please don't say you don't know the answer to this question, because mystic yogis, the verse is 21, mystic yogis can perfectly see that which has not yet happened, as well as things in the past or present, beyond the senses, remote or blocked by physical obstacles. So Sukadeva Goswami began to reply, at her Swayamvara ceremony, Rukmavati herself chose Pradyumna, who was the re-embodiment of Cupid. Then, although he fought alone in a single chariot, Pradyumna defeated the assembled kings in battle and took her away. So that was her desire, it was Rukmini's desire, and it was his own desire too. He was so powerful, all the sons of Krishna were as powerful as we heard it, as Krishna himself. So again, Rukmi organized that she have a Swayamvara ceremony, so she chose her own husband so that he wouldn't have the ignominy of sanctioning it directly. Though Rukmi always remembered his enmity to Lord Krishna, who had insulted him. How did he insult him? Yeah. He cut his hair. The Kshatriyas always have to have beards, and at least a mustache, and beards to show their masculinity. So he cut him, he shaved him, but in such a way he didn't just give him a clean shave, but he scarred him so the hair could grow in some places and not grow back in other places permanently. So he really, and then Balaram came and insulted him further by saying, you shouldn't treat him like this. After all, he's a family member. For a Kshatriya to be given that type of a treatment, very, very, very heavy to say, you know, you should be compassionate to him. You should be kind to him. He's our family member now. So they let him go. And they let him go. What does it mean when you let it, a person who's your enemy, who's trying to kill you, go? It means you don't consider him a threat at all. So they insulted him in that way too. Let him go now. Who cares? So Rukmi always remembered his enmity to his Lord Krishna, and insulted him and scarred him. In order to please his sister, he sanctioned his daughter's marriage to his nephew. So this is the answer to the question of why he did it, in order to please Rukmini. O king, Bali, the son of Kritavarma, married Rukmini's young daughter, large-eyed Charumati. Purport. Srila Swami explains that each of the Lord's queens had one daughter, and that this mention of Charumati's marriage is an indirect reference to the marriages of all these princesses. Rukmi gave his granddaughter Rochana to his daughter's son, Aniruddha. So therefore it's another generation of this. Despite Rukmi's relentless feud with Lord Hari, so he, no matter what, he had his enmity, because again he was a Kshatriya, and Brahmins are known for their forgiveness. Forgiveness is the jewel of the Brahminical mentality. But Kshatriyas, they never forgive. What is it? They say that an elephant never forgets. So also Kshatriyas. And you know why they say that about elephants?
Yes.
Why?
Because if you mistreat an elephant, it'll wait until it gets the turnstone back with its trunk and might wait 20 years or something.
Yeah, or you're walking on the side of him or something like that, and there's a wall over here, and he just leans over and crushes you against the wall or something like that. You know, 20 years later, 10 years later, they don't forget. So everyone should be kind to elephants for your own good, because they don't forget. They'll get you back. So Kshatriyas, he was continuously, so it had gone on, this is the third generation already, it had gone on with Rukmini, still he had unrelenting enmity towards Krishna, and he was trying to kill him continuously. So despite Rukmini's relentless feud with Lord Hari, although Rukmi considered this marriage irreligious, he wanted to please his sister, bound as he was by the ropes of affection. So even someone as obnoxious as Rukmi had affection for his sister, Rukmini. So the softness of the heart, and even in the material world, of course, this is all being encouraged by the Krishna's Lila Shakti and also by the modes of nature. But everyone, even the most hardened person, the most criminal person, has some affection for someone. So he was bound as he was by the ropes of affection for Rukmini. Purport. Srila Sridhar Swami explains that according to worldly standards, one should not give one's beloved granddaughter to the grandson of one's bitter enemy. Thus we find the following injunction: Dvishad anam navoktavyam dvishantam naiva bojayet. One should not eat an enemy's food or feed an enemy. Why shouldn't you eat their food? Huh?
Maybe
that's one practical reason. There's two people, according to diplomacy, should always keep on a good relationship with your elephant, of course, as a diplomat, but also your barber, Because in those days, they used to have barbers who would, you'd go like this, and they would go like this. You know, you can't, because if your enemy bribed your barber, you'd be in a lot of trouble. And the cook, because the cook can poison you. So, from one side, you should not eat an enemy's food, or why shouldn't you feed an enemy?
Why shouldn't you feed an enemy?
Yeah, because that's the other part. You shouldn't eat their food or feed your enemy. Because by your food, he's going to gain strength.
Yeah.
And then he might kill you by his strength. And also, if he's your enemy and you take food from him, your heart will become, this is just the way the person's consciousness, you'll become inclined towards him and softened towards him. And if he's actually your enemy, then he'll take advantage of that softness and fix you good later on. There's also the following prohibition. Asragyam lokabhavishtam dhamanapyacharennatu. One should not execute religious injunctions if they will obstruct one's journey to heaven or if they are odious to human society. If you're going to be criticized, you shouldn't do it. So these are just some practical worldly dharma instructions. It should be pointed out here that Lord Krishna is not really the enemy of anyone. As the Lord states in the Bhagavad Gita, Suridam Savabhutanam Gyatramam Shanti Mritshiti. One achieves peace by understanding that I am the well-wishing friend of every living being. Although Lord Krishna is everyone's friend, Rupmi could not appreciate this fact and considered Lord Krishna his enemy. Still out of affection for his sister, he gave his granddaughter to Aniruddha. Finally, we should note that contrary to the prohibitions quoted above, one may not give up the basic principles of spiritual life merely because such principles are unpopular with people in general. As Lord Krishna states in Bhagavad Gita, Savadamam Pratyaja Mamekam Sharanam Vraja. The last word in spiritual duty is to surrender to the Supreme Lord, and that duty takes precedence over all secondary injunctions. Moreover, in this age, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has kindly presented a sublime process that will attract all sincere people to come to the point of surrendering to the Lord. By following Lord Chaitanya's blissful process of chanting, dancing, feasting, and discussing spiritual philosophy, anyone can easily go back to Godhead for an eternal life of bliss and knowledge. Jai. No worries. Still, someone may argue that the members of the Krishna consciousness movement should not practice in the Western countries those ceremonies or activities that displease people in general. We respond that even in the Western countries, when people are properly informed of the activities of the Krishna consciousness movement, they generally appreciate this great spiritual institution. Those who are especially envious of God will not appreciate any type of religious movement. And such persons are themselves little better than animals. They cannot impede the great Krishna consciousness movement, just as the envious Rupi could not impede the performance of Lord Krishna's pure pastimes. So the pastime continues. On the joyous occasion of that marriage between Aniruddha and Murchana, Queen Rukmini, Lord Balaram, Lord Krishna, and several of the Lord's sons, headed by Sambar and Pradyumna, went to the city of Bhojakata. After the wedding, a group of arrogant kings, headed by the king of Kalinga. Where is Kalinga? What's another name of Kalinga? What is Kalinga today? Utkal, Orissa. So at the a group of arrogant kings after the wedding, headed by the king of Kalinga, told Rukmi, you should defeat Balaram at dice. He's not expert at dice, okay, but he's still quite addicted to it. Thus advised, Rukmini challenged Balaram and began a gambling match with him. Srila Chakravarti Thakur states that he thought he could trick Balaram easily, but he didn't think he could trick Krishna. He was still somewhat afraid of Krishna, knowing how tricky Krishna was. So in that match, Lord Balaram first accepted a wager of 100 gold coins. Then 1,000, then 10,000. Rukmi won this first round. I think Vishwanath said that Balaram he won the first round with me, and then the king, and they were cheating actually, all along. And the king of Kalinga, there's going to be a very important lesson to learn here. And the king of Kalinga laughed loudly at Lord Balaram, showing all his teeth. Lord Balaram could not tolerate this. So he, in Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's purport says, he inwardly became very angry, but outwardly he didn't show it. So Balaram was starting to his anger was starting to blossom, or not blossom, but erupt, but internally at first. So next, Rukmi accepted a bet. So first it started 100, then 1,000, then 10,000 gold coins. Next, Rukmi accepted a bet of 100,000 coins. And Balaram won that bet, 100,000 coins. But Rukmi tried to cheat, declaring, "I'm the winner." And shaking with anger, and all these, his friends were surrounding him, like the king of Kalinga and the others, they all supported him and said, "Yes, of course, Rukmi won." So Balaram was really starting to boil now. He was shaking with anger, like the ocean on the full moon day. The waves were starting to break. Handsome Lord Balaram, his natural reddish eyes even redder in his fury, accepted a wager of 100 million coins, gold coins. 100 million gold coins. Lord Balaram fairly won this wager also, but Rukmi again resorted to cheating and declared, "I have won. Let these witnesses say who has won. Let them say who they saw." And they were all his friends, and they were the ones who had prompted him, because Krishna had, and Balaram had many enemies amongst the Asuras. So they were the ones prompting Rukmi to gamble and cheat, and they were supporting him the whole time. So Rukmi said, "I have won. Let these witnesses here say what they saw." Just then a voice from the sky declared, "Balaram has fairly won this wager. Rukmi is surely lying." But, urged on by the wicked kings, Rukmi ignored the divine voice. But actually, the verse continues saying, destiny itself was urging Rukmi on. And thus he ridiculed Lord Balaram as follows. And Balaram was already angry. Rukmi said, "You cowherds who wander about the forest know nothing about dice. Playing with dice and sporting with arrows are only for kings, not for the likes of you." Thus insulted by Rukmi and ridiculed by the kings, and all the kings laughed when he said that, Lord Balaram was provoked to anger, and in the midst of the auspicious wedding assembly, he raised his club and struck Rukmi dead. Then the king of Kalinga, who had laughed at Lord Balaram and shown his teeth, tried to run away, but the furious lord quickly seized him on his 10th step and knocked out all his teeth. So there's no comment about the on his 10th step, but it's such a nice detail. So how far is 10 steps? Back from here to 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, a little past So he was a bit away, and he was running. He was on the move and running, and Balaram just caught him, grabbed him, and knocked his teeth out with his club. Tormented by Lord Balaram's club, the other kings fled in fear, their arms, thighs, and heads broken, and their bodies drenched in blood. And when his brother-in-law, Rukmi, was slain, Lord Krishna neither applauded nor protested, O king, for he feared jeopardizing his affectionate ties with either Rukmini or Balaram. So it's explained now how Krishna reacted to this. After all, it was Krishna's grandson's wedding, and Balaram loses his temper and kills the grandfather of the bride and knocks out the teeth of one of the other kings, and there's blood everywhere. At such an auspicious event like this, and so we'll talk about that, and then also what about how did Krishna react to this? So Krishna remained neutral, because superficially, if he would take Balaram's side, yes, he deserved it, this Rukmini deserved it, then Rukmini may get angry at him, because after all, it was her brother. And if he took Rukmini's side, Balaram, why did you do this on the auspicious occasion? Like, that's what Balaram told him. You can't kill your brother-in-law on the auspicious occasion of your marriage with Rukmini will ruin everything. So if he took Rukmini's side, then Balaram may get upset with him. So Krishna just stayed neutral. Then the descendants of Darsaha, headed by Lord Balaram, seated Aniruddha and his bride on a fine chariot, native Kshatriyas. They just went on with it. The marriage was already performed. They just went on. He seated his bride, Rosena, on a fine chariot and set off from Bhojakata to Dwaraka. Having taken shelter of Lord Madhusudan, they had fulfilled all their purposes. Purport. Even though Rukmini was very dear to all the Dasaharas, her brother Rukmi had constantly opposed and insulted Krishna since Rukmini's wedding. Thus Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti explains, the associates of Lord Krishna could hardly lament Rukmini's sudden demise, and even Rukmini actually is only superficially attached to him, Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur describes. So she wasn't actually attached to him, just like Prahlad Maharaj, when Lord Nisringadev killed Prahlad's father, Hiranyakashipu, rather than being upset, Prahlad, he told Lord Nisringadev that even a sadhu is satisfied and happy when a serpent is killed. So you don't have to worry that I'm upset that my father's been killed. Not that Lord Nisringadev was worried, but. So, what do you think of that? What do you think of?
Is this particular verse, or is there some sort of transcendental purport?
Well, that's what I'm saying. That these next three, four chapters, this one and the next three chapters, all superficially seem mundane, in a sense, all Krishna's dealings. And look how Balaram acted, too. If you heard of this happening at a wedding ceremony, and someone teases granduncle, we would say, the granduncle of the bride, and he gets angry and kills him.
While they're playing gambling match.
And they're just gambling. Anyway, what's 100 million gold coins to
them?
They're
playing gambling in one field with the other one. What's so transcendent about that?
It would be like in the newspaper.
Yeah. It would
even...
loses it.
...the marriage. Cheating, conspiracy, corruption,
murder. They're on a couple of murder charges.
But you wouldn't want to be the people who come and collect him, you know, say, excuse me, Balaram, will you? Yeah, by the way, you know, this is against the law. So the dealings are all very transcendental. So what do we learn from this one? So that was one of the things I was going to bring out, that externally, and this happens also in the next chapter as well, and the next chapter where Banasura is killed, and then the next chapter is also these kind of family dealings, but there are deep transcendental lessons in all of them. And here, what do we learn? One of the obvious things is
that you need the help of the acharyas to actually go beyond the conventional morality.
Well, there's the point, that Krishna is absolute good. And we hit this point so many times in Krishna's pastimes that by definition, whatever he does is good. So morality is for us who live within the modes of material nature and have a tendency naturally for lower activities, which will degrade the soul and cause them to go down and entangle them further in karma. But Krishna has nothing to do with the modes of material nature whatsoever, and he has nothing to do with morality. So this is expressed by Krishna practically from the very beginning of his pastimes in Braja, because as soon as he can walk and crawl and walk, first thing he starts doing is stealing butter. He starts stealing. And then he dances with the wives of others. And then these kind of activities are always going on. So Lord Ramachandra, as the Maryada Purusha, he displayed perfect morality in that avatar. But when Krishna comes, he displays the transcendence of the absolute and supreme person who does not have to abide by any of the laws of the prison house in the material world, meant to govern the prisoners in the material world. So Krishna and Balaram, they simply do as they like. And at times, they have their Naralila, and then at other times, which they display complete superhuman activities that can't be imitated. So if we could imitate Lord Balaram, we get angry at someone and we say, well, Balaram killed them, so I'm going to, he killed someone who made him angry, so therefore I have a full right to kill whoever makes me angry. But when Lord Balaram does that, he also does unlimited other things too. When Akura saw Balaram in the waters with Krishna of the Yamuna, he saw him as Anantashesha. He saw him as the Supreme Lord's primal expansion. Lord Narayan, or Lord Gopalaksha Vishnu's expansion. Shesha, Anantashesha. So whatever Krishna does, whatever Balaram does, this is the definition of good, practically speaking. So we can look at it from that simple philosophical point of view, and we could also look at it from the practical point of view that everyone, even if someone is killed by Krishna, they're liberated by that. And this doesn't happen, by the way, as Jiva Goswami describes, that it's not when any incarnation comes and they kill an asura that the asura is liberated. It's only Krishna who liberates. This is one of the specific characteristics of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Bhagavan Sri Krishna, is that he liberates all those he kills. So it's for their great benefit and their great fortune, ultimately, because when one is envious of Krishna, like Rukmi was envious of Krishna, that means he's naturally going to be envious of so many people. So if we are envious of Krishna, and that then we're imagining ourselves the center of existence, and immediately we have friends and enemies. And then when we have friends and enemies, we entangle ourselves in the material world and material activities and material karma, and naturally we go downward. And the purpose of our life is misused. So Rukmi, of course, this, we could say that it's all going on by Krishna's Leela Shakti, his potency of pastimes, but looking at it in a simpler way, that how fortunate he was to be killed directly by the club of Balaram. And that's what when Aditi was told that she was going to give birth to two demons named Aranyakasipu and Aranyaksha, she was very, very upset. But as soon as she heard that the demons would be killed by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vishnu, her anxiety went away. And when Aranyaksha was killed by Lord Varaha Dev, immediately Lord Brahma came and glorified his death, saying, "What a fortunate death this is." So from the point of view of morality, Krishna transcends it. And from the point of view of benefiting those whoever Krishna deals with, even if he kills them, it's also fortuitous. Anyone
those
else want?
Come up against this mysterious puzzle of the absolute, the unlimited, and the person.
Say again?
You come up against this mysterious puzzle, to understand how the absolute is unlimited. It can be a person, because a person means that you've got, you know, the definition of size and space and qualification and quality.
But then, okay, but even more than that, too, that he's the absolute truth and he's a person, and he has qualities and he has likes and characteristics and dislikes, and he gets angry, but he's all good. Well, it's certainly beyond the finite mind.
It's interesting what you were speaking about yesterday about Bhaktivinoda Thakur and his comment, you know, about what the rational mind can accept as an abstract sort of without any service. Rational mind can do that, but it can't actually penetrate into this.
It can't penetrate into this.
So therefore it feels a little affronted and, you know, refuses to surrender if it's not purified.
What does it mean for the rational mind, rational intelligence, to be purified? It means to accept its position as not supreme. It wants to rule, but it doesn't. But it's not supreme anyway, intelligence, because it rules on behalf of the mind. Always, it's a paid worker. That's like the, you know, when the these people do studies, you know, the tobacco companies, they hire scientists from the universities to do studies to prove that tobacco is good for your health, something like that. And they come out with these papers and research findings that there's nothing better for your health than tobacco or something like that, and smoking cigarettes. And mobile phones is actually no harm. Doesn't cause harm for anyone.
You're good for you.
Yeah, that warm feeling that you're holding up to your ears, you know, it's good for the winter.
Should want them both ears.
They should have for the winter they should have heating ones, and for the summer they should have cooling ones. That's what they But you know, the scientists, you know, they're not actually brahmanas. Brahmanas are independent, and therefore they can be honest. But they're paid workers, so therefore you can't bite the hand that feeds you, as the saying goes, because you won't get your cookies anymore if you do that. Your dog biscuits. So they're sutras for that reason. That's why Prabhupada, even though they're intelligent, they have the mentality of workers, and they're forced to subservient their intelligence to the mind of their boss. Yeah, the other one that they recently, in the last few years, is with Australia and the United States. They all came out and said there's no such thing as global warming. Remember that? Just a few years ago, during John Howard's time. They all came out. Research doesn't give any evidence of global warming. And then within a year after that, you know, they just went bloop. They just completely flipped on it. Yeah, just they're rascals. What can one say? If one looks at it objectively, they're rascals.
So one has to have a faculty developed that's stronger than his rational intelligence in order to be able to put his rational intelligence into proper perspective.
One has to be very intelligent, in other words, to understand your rational intelligence is limited. So you have to be humble, and that's, which is a step towards subservience towards something. Because arrogance and the pride, that's what it was clear, like the greatest of scientists, they were humble. And just, you know, the petty little ones, the arrogant ones.
Einstein and Newton.
Those are the two. So humble. Very religious. Yeah, but what?
I think that's interesting. That's an interesting point. Like, two greatest ones are so humble. But it's argued whether Einstein was theistic. He was kind of pantheistic.
Yeah, but Newton was.
Newton was theistic.
Yeah. Einstein wasn't a member of any religion.
But he was humble. He was in awe of the universe rather than some of the modern ones who think we're going to control and dominate.
Very unlikely, isn't it? Control, dominate the universe.
Get more research dollars.
Keep those checks coming in. What do you think, Harry Potter? Do you think they're going to be able to control the universe? I mean, this is a big universe, if you think about it.
I was just wondering, you know, when Mataji was saying that the rational mind won't be able to actually accept or understand this sort of personal God. So has it got to be that things indirectly, like hearing by the holy name, through devotees chanting, or by accident helping... giving some assistance to saintly people and indirectly being friendly with and that has a big part to play.
That's the part that it's in piety ultimately.
Otherwise you can't get it otherwise.
It's in piety that covers the soul. Mm-hmm. So there has to be, the soul has to be uncovered, and that's, and one's vision changes, just like when you're I find that like every 10 years, if you look back what you were doing 10 years ago, you just think how foolish you were, and you know, only if you knew what you knew now 10 years ago, you could have lived a better life. So that means your conceptual ability and intelligence is growing. So if So what causes it to grow? It's a maturation. So what causes one's perceptive ability to grow is a maturation on the spiritual level, which comes from exactly the things that you mentioned. That comes from, that's agyata sukriti. But then when it becomes conscious, agyata means you do things in an unknowing way. You do some spiritual piety, but you don't really, not aware of your doing it. And see, we're going to get the example of that in the 64th chapter, which is another chapter that's superficially appears just ordinary, like the story of King Riga, who's, you know, he turns into a lizard, he's helped out, and, you know, why I gave so many cows in charity, and I became a lizard because I, this amazing thing was I gave away one cow to two people, and, you know, it doesn't appear very deeply spiritual either, but there is an incredible lesson to be learned, and that's revealed by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, and that's basically the lesson, that if you do some service consciously, willingly, just do some service for an exalted sadhu as King Riga did, then the result is that you saw Krishna. So yes, exactly.
So the people we see, say, for example, at Sunday feast, who are not devotees as such, and are not offensive, so they would be accumulating some unknowing, if they're not doing active service, knowingly. So they would still be purifying themselves?
Oh yeah, for sure. And then gradually they come to the point of gradually understanding what goes on, what's going on there with the chanting and with the philosophy. And then it becomes first, most of the people come because it's just cultural. There's, you know, they're looking for something to do on a Sunday afternoon. It reminds them of India. They feel lonely and homesick or something.
Or hungry.
Lonely, homesick. Well, that's what happens when you're lonely and homesick. You're hungry.
Or they want some moral stamina in their family. You know, they want to give something for their children.
Yeah, those kind of reasons.
Well,
those kind of more or less external reasons. But then, by hearing and in the association of devotees, Srimad Bhagavata Shravan, by association with devotees, by hearing the holy names, by hearing the philosophy, studying the Bhagavatam. The Bhagavatam is so powerful. Just by hearing the Bhagavatam, one becomes purified. What to speak of if one desires to hear it. Vidunoti Suritsitam Krishna within the heart, Vijantisto Yabadrani, Vidunoti Suritsitam. You know, just by hearing the Bhagavatam, one's heart becomes purified, and it's the coverings over the heart that cause our lack of ability to understand things in the proper perspective. Just like 10 years ago, we didn't understand as much as we understand now. So similarly, these are the different maturations of these things. This type of service, because after all, chanting the holy names of Krishna is service. That's one of the main angas of bhakti, one of the parts of bhakti. Taking prasadam. Seva mukhi ji jiva dao.
Thank you.
Any other points or questions?
It takes also a further development of your consciousness or awareness to sort of go beyond these stories as being stories, like you know, sort of like beads on a thread, that's all there is, to sort of explore the idea that this is just a few little things that happen in the course of so many extraordinary things that are happening day by day. Because Krishna is a person, so he gets up in the morning every day. He doesn't just sort of, when he closes the book, he doesn't just go into nothing until we open the book again. And he's real. going on, it's really happening there, and it's more real than here, which seems so real to us now.
But everything that Krishna does, and Balaram, everything is very attractive. He does it in such a wonderful way. He's such, they're such heroes. So, and their days are filled with wonderful heroic activities.
That's what makes it almost seem like a fairy story. Because there aren't any real heroes here. I mean, they're heroes, but they're
good. Never, there's a lesson. This is the age of the anti-hero.
Yeah.
The opposite of a hero.
When you say Krishna's a hero in our sense is somebody who faces with danger.
Yeah.
There's no danger for Krishna, so how can he be a hero?
He does everything with great courage. But yeah, it's an interesting point that a hero doesn't, according to our definition, that definition, it doesn't quite work for Krishna, but he's the central character in the great drama of existence. In that sense, he's the hero.
Because he does it in style.
He really does it in style. He's got style. But
he's
actually,
the style of the movie.
There's other things that happen too. That he doesn't face danger, but yet he feels fear. When his mother is chastising him, he actually feels fear. He doesn't want to get into trouble, because we can't understand exactly what his consciousness is like, but we know that the love of his devotees forces him, in one sense, just like the queens, as we heard about yesterday. They force him to act as a husband and always stay by their side, because they love him with such intensity. Because that quality of Krishna is being Bhakta Vatsalya. It is so wonderful, actually, that so when you're watching, when we hear these pastimes, we should hear them from the point of rasa, too. So how is this increasing ecstasy in the devotees and in Krishna? Because that's the ultimate platform of the pastimes. Huh?
And all the people who are there, they don't actually feel like, oh, you know, this is the Supreme Godhead acting and he'll be alright, you know, nothing really can hurt.
Because of love,
they're completely frightened or worried. Or
part of love, to be in, to love someone means that you're going to be in anxiety about their safety. Even if they're the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Prema causes anxiety. And this is the waves of the Bhakti Rasamrita syndrome.
And then that anxiety is bliss, not the anxiety we
No
material world.
Because there's a center to it. The center is Krishna, the sky above. But it's not, anyway, he's God, he's going to kill him, don't worry about it. You know, what's there to worry about? Change the channel. Watch a sports match. You don't know who's going to win. You always know Krishna's going to win. But oh, how he does it in his style. But also, the devotees don't think like that. Maharaj Prickett understood that Krishna was the Supreme Personality of God, but Sukadev didn't even want to tell him the story about Kaliya. Krishna chastising Kaliya, because, and even though it had a happy ending, with he knew the story, he didn't want to tell it to him, because there were 48 minutes where Krishna was enwrapped in the coils of the snake, and that would have been so disturbing for Maharaj Prickett. That's why, and Sukadeva just mentions it briefly, was about to go on, but then Maharaj Prickett asked about it, because it's just the very nature of love to be concerned about one's beloved. Regardless who one's beloved is.
And people, you know, here in this world, they kind of, quote, enjoy that kind of anxiety here, even though it's not pure love, it's you know, it's so relative. But still, even here, people who love somebody, they're always thinking of them, and they experience some kind of
this is how they express their love. Mm-hmm. It just comes from, it's part of prema, completely different from impersonalism, where the goal is a non-existence of any emotion, practically. But personalism is something completely different, where one has all the experiences, including anger. Anger, yes, anger. Anger is allowed. Gautama Das Thakur, even he talks about that in Prem Bhakti Chandrika. The best use of anger is on those, because you can't stop anger, because it's emotions come from the soul. But pure emotions come from the soul uncovered, that's not covered by Maya. So they spring from the soul, and they become angry at Rukmi. The pure emotions, even Rukmi. That was the point there. And look at the rasa that Krishna did. In it he just, he didn't, because he didn't kill Rukmi. It's so ironic that he was about to, he was really giving Rukmi a hard time, and Balaram came and preached to him, said, you can't do this. And now Krishna's not allowed to, Krishna doesn't kill him, but he has him killed. And why does Krishna have him killed? Because he's a demon. And he's come to this world. Yada yada hidamasya glaniya bhavati bhavati bhutanamadamasya tadatmanam sridhamya. He's come specifically on the request of Bhumi and Brahma to remove the demonic, the overburden of the earth. And Rukmi is one of them. He's got to go. So Krishna does these things through Arjuna, through Balaram, and through his other agents. And with Jarasandha, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he explains that Jarasandha attacked Krishna Mathura 17 times. 17. And each time he was defeated. And Krishna could have killed him right in the beginning. But he thought, why should I go so far to kill all the ungodly forces in this world? I'll just stay here, let Jarasandha come, and he'll bring them to me, and then we'll kill them. Why should I have to go and kill them? So this is part of the overall plan, nevertheless. But just look how Krishna did it so gracefully, without even lifting his finger, and not even, so no one could accuse him of killing his relative. He had to kill Kamsa, of course. He just did it to Balaram, and he remained neutral.
By comparison, Yudhisthira was cheated and gambling and insulted, but he didn't want to fight to be known.
That was his fault.
His fault.
Yeah. Yeah, he didn't want to tell a lie. That was his fault.
So someone said he's more virtuous than Balaram because he tolerated where Balaram.
Well, then, yeah, that's the way the mundane mind works. Exactly. And Krishna's
a villain because he asked Arjuna who was pacifist to fight.
Yeah, this is exactly how the mind stuck having the contamination of the mode of goodness, you know, being more moral than the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This is just how Maya works for someone like that. And the mind will think like that, too. Because the mind's business is to find reasons not to surrender to Krishna. So the mind will think like that. It will, it must. It will find some way or another. It's as clever as a fox. It will find some excuse or way or another. If Balaram didn't do that, you know, the mind would find another excuse to criticize. So that's the very nature of the mind. to protect the false ego, to find using pulls on the intelligence to make these elaborate arguments. Why shouldn't
One time Prabhupada said that anyone who is here in this material world is an enemy of Krishna.
Well, yeah, it's true. Well, there's two kinds of people in this world. There's the divine and there's the demonic. The devotees and the demons. Very, very, sometimes Prabhupada would speak so strongly like that. He'd just make the line. And of course, as being young devotees, when Prabhupada would do that, most of us would think, yeah, commies are all, they're all the demons and we're all the divine. But now, now it's quite, we don't quite feel the same way.
But it's the false ego that is the enemy.
Huh?
The particle of the false ego is the enemy. So unless the false ego is removed, we still have the essence of enmity.
Mm. And it's enmity. It's enmity with Krishna. It's not just neutral. Anyway, you want to be God. Okay, you can be God, but also I want to be God too. No, it's enmity with Krishna.
Yeah.
Deep anger, aversion.
That's why it's not so easy to become Krishna conscious overnight. Because there's it's a bit of a blockade.
It's called false ego. But it's also not easy to become Krishna conscious over hundreds and thousands of years. Unless one develops love for Krishna, and that's what Kapila Muni explains, that the devotional service dissolves the false ego. Okay, it's 8:30 already. But anyway, there's more of these kind of stories too. Now, the next one is
physical
also
physical rational mind.
Yeah,
just double rational part of the brain that's still ticking your head.
Yeah. The next one is, I mean, who do you identify with in one sense when Usha calls in Aniruddha? Again, Aniruddha, and he's living with the king's daughter right in the palace, right in her own quarters. I mean, and why shouldn't he be angry? Right? This is the same thing. The same principle is going to come out again. The rational mind, we read it as like a story, but we're trying to look at things a little more deeply. The rational mind thinks that when you think about it, of course his name is Banasura, so you know you're not going to take his side because his name is Asura, Mr. Asura. So we know not to take his side on principle, but if you think about it a little bit, I mean, who wouldn't get angry? This guy's living in your house with your daughter, and you don't even know about it. And then he walks in, and he's just sitting there in front of you, just enjoying. He's not even disturbed. He doesn't even have any shame. He doesn't say, "Whoops, I'm sorry," or "I have another appointment." Or he's just sitting there enjoying. And then Banasura gets angry, and how can you not? I mean, but he's wrong, because he's against Krishna.
False ego struggles with that, doesn't it?
Yeah.
He struggles with that.
And you put yourself in that condition. What would I do if my daughter or something like that?
You immediately take as if Krishna is like you. You put yourself in Krishna's like me. You shouldn't do this.
No, we're doing the other one this time. We're putting. But see, this time is a good. This one's much better because in that particular case that we'll hear about tomorrow, we're not putting ourselves in Krishna's shoes. We put ourselves in Banasura's shoes. So then we become. Then we understand what we're doing at least. Oh yeah, I'm identifying with Banasura. Okay, Hare Krishna. Anyway, I find these pastimes so fascinating.
That's what we're doing all the time when we're in a society.
in the time of Banasura.
Yeah, exactly.